to give a primer, essentially, for theorists on some of the experimental considerations when looking at signal processing and these precision measurements. And of course, half the room here is experts already in precision measurements, so I hope everyone finds what I have to say reasonable, and I invite people to make comments or ask questions as I go through the material. So as anyone who does precision measurement experiments knows, oftentimes it's the systematic effects that are very specific to each individual system that are the most challenging things to figure out and to overcome. And so that's not going to be the topic of the talk today. I'm going to focus more on the statistical noise kind of issues in certain kinds of precision measurements. So in particular, I'm going to spend the time mostly focusing on measurements of force and displacement. And I'll talk about some of the limitations associated with Brownian motion and thermal noise, as well as far as displacement detection, laser shot noise, and measurement back action. And I'll say a little bit about not only the I'll say a little bit also about the quantum regime, where we're now in a place in the community where we're able to actually access quantum behavior in these mechanical systems. And so I'll say something about how some of the methods that we can use to get to the quantum regime and what the limits are in the quantum regime. And I also just want to point out, of course, that many of the precision techniques or experiments we've heard about rely on measurements of spin states or internal states of atoms, for example. And in this case, the kinds of noise that you worried about are distinct from these the kind in the mechanical type measurements. So I'm not going to say anything about this kind of noise, although we've heard already quite a bit about it already in the meeting, and I think we'll hear more about it to come. So I'm just going to focus on this to keep it short and hopefully keep us on track to get to the coffee on time. So, okay, so I guess I thought maybe this was an appropriate picture for thermal noise considering this morning's fire drill incident. So you have a system in contact with a heat bath, right, and you have some thermal energy that's going to cause some jittering or random motion. So for example, in a harmonic oscillator, or Johnson noise in a resistor gives you random voltage fluctuations. And it depends on the temperature, so you can, of course, control it if you reduce the temperature of the environment. But ultimately, this represents one of the main practical limitations in terms of statistical sensitivity of these kind of precision experiments. And so the history, of course, it goes all the way back to the 1800s, where Brown was looking at the random motion of pollen and fluid, and Einstein, many years later, established a theory to describe what was going on there and pointed out that it has a dependence on the viscosity. About 20 years later, Johnson and Nyquist explained the Johnson noise or voltage noise in the resistors, and it wasn't until maybe 25 years or so later that all this was kind of connected and put together in the framework of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, which relates random motion to dissipative channels. Okay, so as we already heard about actually yesterday, I mean, this thermal Brownian motion is playing a significant limitation in a number of different precision measurement experiments, in particular in atomic clocks. So here's a photo from the website of Junyi. We heard a nice talk from Ed Marty yesterday on this fantastic new precision they're getting in these optical atomic clocks. So here you have this ultra-stable Fabry-Pro resonator where you have this very precise length standard, but now you're limited by the thermal motion of the tiny high reflectivity coatings that are at the end of this structure, and that's actually starting to pose one of the limits in terms of the ability to find that length standard. And so improving this Brownian noise would have, in principle, a direct effect on improving these future clocks. And of course, we heard a great talk in the previous session on gravitational waves. The thermal Brownian motion is, of course, one of the main noise backgrounds that is considered in these experiments as well, where we have a large optical cavity resonator. And so in these LIGO-style detectors, then the thermal noise in the end mirrors actually is a limitation, whether it's coming from the suspension of the end mirrors or the coatings on the end mirrors themselves. So the interferometer detectors basically look to detect a gravitational wave coming across the plane of the interferometer, where you have this quadrupole type pattern of the distortion of space-time, which changes the physical length of the arms of the interferometer. And then by measuring the an interferometer output, you can deduce something about the strain of space-time. And so of course, the strains that are involved here are really tiny, as we already heard in the previous talk, you know, talking about 10 to the minus 22 kind of fractional changes in length. And so being that these signals are so small, the noise is you know, quite significant in many cases. And so at the low frequency end, you have seismic motion from just ground vibration and Newtonian noise from gravity and so forth. There's often a middle frequency band where it's in fact this thermal Brownian motion that due to the finite temperature of the apparatus that's producing the limit. And then in the higher frequency end, you have the shot noise, which is basically from the discrete nature of photons, where you're counting the photons to or measuring a phase rather to determine the length of the cavity. So so the sensitivity, this is I guess one of the older sensitivity curves from the initial LIGO detector, but you can see this is a function of frequency, the strain here in per root hertz. So there's a sort of seismic noise floor at low on the low frequency end, and then there's some thermal noise where that Brownian motion is providing the limit in terms of your strain sensitivity, and then at higher frequency you start to get to displacement displacement noise due to the shot noise of the photons.
Well, it's largely actually the radiation pressure fluctuations on the two mirrors.
Sorry, in which case? In
well, the shot noise is you see the radiation pressure at high power.
Well, so the shot noise here, this is having to do with the measurement and precision of your ability
right,
to measure
I'm
the interferometer.
There's a physical motion of the mirrors.
Yes.
Due to the discreteness of the photons also. It turns
yeah,
out.
That's
yeah.
right. So that's what's called the
radiation pressure,
yeah. And that's on here as well. And that has not yet been a limit, although it's expected to be an advanced LIGO to be one of the limits. I'm going to talk about right. that more at the end
but
of the talk.
But it's equal to the shot noise in that.
I'm not sure what you mean by equal. So,
so
it depends on the frequency, right? So,
yeah,
so,
in the high frequency regime,
yeah.
it's as important as the shot noise in that particular plot. And LIGO is going to have more power in the future,
yes.
which is going to improve the shot noise.
Absolutely, but it's going to make this worse.
Make that worse. And
absolutely, yeah,
in that
that's
old
right.
plot, they were equal importance.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so in this particular setup, right.
right.
But in the new setup, the radiation pressure is
going to
be important. Right, that's right. Yeah, and actually, so I'll show later some slides on the first experimental measurement of that radiation pressure shot noise in a different system, and then you're right that in advanced LIGO that's expected to be an issue. So the thermal Brownian motion anyway is playing some role in this kind of mid frequency band in these kind of systems, and then here's some I guess this is some actual data from the earlier science runs of the initial LIGO. Where you can see this contribution here from the thermal noise floor. Okay, so also in these precision force measuring experiments like the one I talked about yesterday, we're also concerned with thermal Brownian motion as a fundamental limit to the sensitivity. So I showed this slide yesterday, for example, looking at a cantilever beam as an example of a harmonic oscillator. You have a restoring force with some Hooke's law. You have some natural resonance frequency in the system. This could be a membrane, a cantilever, a levitated particle, whatever. It's some harmonic oscillator. And so you have some resonance behavior where you can excite the system on resonance, and you'll get an enhancement of the amplitude that's given by this mechanical quality factor, which is associated with the dissipation. So the dissipation is playing an important role in the sensitivity here. And so the dissipation is essentially the fractional energy lost per oscillation for this mechanical quality factor here. And so if you can write it in terms of the parameters of the damped simple harmonic oscillator, as the essentially the product of the mass and spring constant square root over this damping coefficient, and this dissipation, as we'll see, plays a significant role in the sensitivity for if you're limited by this thermal Brownian motion. So first, let's look at the linear response of a harmonic oscillator system. So just taking the cantilever as a typical example. So now I want to consider the case where I have the common simple harmonic oscillator equation of motion, where now I insert some driving force. Now, in general, that driving force is going to be some signal that you're trying to search for, or some force you're trying to detect, plus the random thermal force from the background thermal environment. But so let's start off with just a harmonic driving force. So you have some amplitude and frequency of this sinusoidally varying force. And so then we can write down the equation, putting in this ansatz for the force. And we can define something called the mechanical susceptibility, which is basically the response in terms of displacement that you get to an applied force. So it's kind of like a generalized spring constant. So in the DC or low frequency limit, then the displacement is just the force over the spring constant, as you'd expect for mass on a spring. And you'll see in the limit that the frequency gets to infinity, then this susceptibility decays like the 1 over the square of the frequency. So this is actually the principle on which a lot of vibration isolation systems are built, where you have some resonance in the system. You go much higher frequency than the resonance, and you get a big suppression of the amplitude because that mechanical susceptibility is dying off at the high frequency. Okay, so I can look at the kind of steady state behavior if I have a constant driving force, some amplitude, where now I can write the displacement as the real part of the susceptibility times my driving force here to get my cosine omega t. And the I can write this in terms of some amplitude times cosine of omega t minus some phase phi. So the amplitude here is going to be this factor. It looks like this Lorentzian shape here. And the tangent of that angle is given in terms of the frequency times gamma over this difference in the squares of the resonance from where the frequency of you're driving the system. So on resonance, for example, when you drive the system, you get a 90-degree phase shift. And on resonance, then you have the maximum value of this term, right, where the denominator here is that term is canceled out. And so we can look at this amplitude as a response basically to a driving force, a harmonic driving force, and plot it as a function of frequency. And so basically you have some amplitude that's going to be the DC or low frequency amplitude times this factor here, which I've rewritten now, where I've replaced the damping coefficient here, gamma, with the omega over Q. And so now I have the Q factor, mechanical Q factor appearing here. And on resonance, you see that this Q factor comes up to the numerator, and there's a linear scaling with Q for the driving on the peak of the resonance. So there's dissipation, right? And so we can look at the power steady state that's dissipated in the system by looking at this force velocity product. And so I can write this down, taking the derivative here. You can see this is proportional to this imaginary part of the susceptibility. So the imaginary part of that susceptibility is associated with dissipation, where that form of the imaginary part is written like here, where I have this linear frequency dependence in the numerator, and I have this denominator here as follows with this frequency difference here from the resonance squared. On resonance, plugging in those to be equal, then you have dissipated power that looks like the this frequency over gamma looks like the Q factor, right? And then it's of this form, right? So So the now, what does it have to do with the thermal noise? So the as I was mentioning in the previous talk, so there's a fundamental limit on the force measurement you can detect, or a small force you can detect in the presence of the thermal noise. And so, like the case of Brown looking at the pollen in the fluid, this cantilever is in contact with a thermal bath. And so we're gonna plug in this equipartition theorem to derive this formula, which is the formula for the minimum detectable force that you can see in the presence of this thermal background. And again, this is the thermal energy kT times the spring constant of the simple harmonic oscillator divided by the product of the frequency and the Q. And then this B is going to be the measurement bandwidth, all that to the one half.
Yeah. The power dissipated is maximized, right? In the previous slide. Is it the maximum value you can take?
Yeah, so I guess you can, right, so I guess I don't know if I can differentiate that in real time, but you can see. So yeah, so this.
Omega equals omega zero, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's gonna zero out this term, right? Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah. Right. Okay, so let's look at this formula now. So I want to consider the case where now I'm driving here not with just a single sine wave, but I'm gonna drive with some random force that's called a Langevin force that has some properties. So it's a thermal, it's a random stationary process in that it has a zero expectation value, but it has a non-zero value of the square, so there's some fluctuations in that force. And what we see under these conditions is that the oscillator is going to vary, essentially oscillate at its resonance frequency. I guess this frequency is very slightly perturbed by the value of a damping coefficient. There's some natural resonance frequency, which for small damping is pretty close to this omega naught. And what we'll find is that the amplitude and the phase of this oscillation varies on some timescale because it's being driven by this thermal random force. And that timescale is of order 1 over gamma, the damping coefficient. So similarly, there's some heating rate in the system. If you take the oscillator, if you have n here, let's let n be the average number of thermal phonons or quanta of vibration in the oscillator. So that is that number of phonons is damped with the same time constant here times the difference of the thermal average occupation of the environment from your occupation number. And so for example, if you were to look at the case where you take the system out of equilibrium, then there's some re-equilibration back to the thermal temperature of the environment on some time scale given by that same damping coefficient. And if you had this oscillator near the ground state, then there'd be some rate at which you heat from the environment, which is basically given by the product of this thermal environment occupation times the damping coefficient, which basically goes like kT over the h bar Q. So this is like the thermalization rate of the system, the rate in which energy is put back into the system. Okay, so if I look at the time record of the displacement of one of these oscillators, I can record a time series, for example, for some time, and I can take the Fourier transform of it to create a function of frequency. Then if I take the norm squared of that average, I create something that's the spectral density of position fluctuations. So there's a theorem, I'm not going to try to prove it, the Wiener-Khtinchen theorem, which basically says that if you have a stationary random process, like in our case we expect for a thermal environment, then this correlation, expectation of the correlation between the position at some time and some earlier time is integrated over frequency here is going to give me the position, or sorry, integrated over time rather, is going to give me the position spectral density of as a function of frequency for position fluctuations in the oscillator. And so then if I take that spectral density of position fluctuations and I integrate it over all frequencies, then I recover the RMS, or the, not the RMS, but the average of the square of the displacement. So if I were to plot the function here for the position spectral density, there's some width here around the mechanical resonance that's given by that mechanical damping. And then the area under this curve is going to be the square of the expectation of the square of the RMS fluctuations. Okay, so now going on to the thermal noise. So if I have thermal noise is a white background, so there's no frequency dependence to it, but the spectral density, yeah. Well, okay, sure. In real systems, there's often colored noise, like from one over F noise and things like that.
Exactly.
And so I'm only treating the case of the white noise from thermal fluctuations, which is
because
theoretically expected, right?
Because every degree of freedom must have KT, is that there is, so where does the connection between thermal noise having been frequency independent been white noise for the force?
It's if you look at the autocorrelation function, it's thermal, it drops to zero as soon as there's a finite displacement. If you correlate the time series from two independent measurements, if they had the same starting point, you get perfect correlation. If it's random, that's what they mean by thermal here. Random.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so as long as you go away, no matter how short the time scale,
it goes to zero. It's a delta function.
I see. Okay.
And so it's the assumption of randomness that gives you that delta function.
Okay.
And then that makes it white noise and all
that. Okay.
Right, yeah, thank you. Yeah. That's a reasonable way to think about it. So in any case, the spectral density of position is then related to the spectral density of force. Through this mechanical susceptibility again that I showed in the previous couple of slides, right? And so this we expect to be a white background. However, this does have a frequency dependence as we just plotted on the previous view graph, right? It clearly has some response that depends on the frequency. And so the integral under that, we can connect to this average of x squared, right? So I can. This is a constant. I can take it in the integral, and now I'm rewriting the susceptibility in terms of this amplitude function, which I showed on the previous a couple slides ago. And I can actually compute this integral analytically. And so from that, then you can relate the square root of this constant to the RMS motion of the particle. And so there's some constant proportionality here. We have the spring constant, and then we have this,
assumption that S sub F, the power, spectral density of the force,
is white. Yeah.
Force is white. That's an assumption because gamma could be frequency dependent. If it's the residual gas effect, it's frequency independent.
So I'm assuming gamma is constant in this case. That's right. Yeah.
Talk about the case where it isn't.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So maybe let's.
So I'm going to build on his.
Okay. So we'll defer that perhaps to Eric's talk. And but yeah, that's a good comment. Yeah. Okay. So in the constant case where gamma is constant and this is white, you can derive the relation between this spectral density square root of the force spectral density and that RMS displacement. And here's where the equipartition theorem comes in now, because we know that this 1/2 kT for degree of freedom we can use to relate the temperature to the RMS displacement of the particle on the spring. Here, with this is the spring constant. And so using that now, I can plug in the formula here and then calculate the spectral density of the force in terms of the temperature. And this is the form then that leads me to this, to derive the result for the minimum detectable force. So this thing has quantity, is in units of newtons per square root of hertz. So to get newtons, I have to multiply by the square root of the measurement bandwidth, or 1 over the integration time, 1 over the square root of the integration time, to find how small of a force I can see in a given, after averaging down for a given time, right? So there's some thermal spectrum of noise here that averages down like the square root of the averaging time. Okay, and so, for example, going back to my previous talk, for example, I didn't talk about this in detail, but we have a cantilever beam, for example, that's using these gravitational measurements. We can have thermal noise sensitivities that are at the attonewton or tens of attonewtons per hertz level in a cryogenic system with a Q of about 10 to the 5. And so if we look at the measurements here in these kind of experiments and we average down, if we have a signal that in this case we're only looking at thermal noise, there's no coherent driving, then I can measure the force from watching the displacement of the oscillator. And if I average down with time, we see this will go down like 1 over the square root of the averaging time, which is exactly what I'd expect for this random thermal noise limited process. On the other hand, if you have a signal present above the thermal background, then what you'd expect and what you actually see when you drive it with a real signal is that this force actually levels off at some finite value where the effect of this thermal fluctuations is continuing to get suppressed as you continue the averaging time, but then you have a stronger signal on top of that that does not average away. So here's, for example, a sinusoidal driving coherent amplitude on top of the thermal Langevin force, and this is when you only have the Langevin force. So I wanted to just also mention that the force sensing with these nano oscillators has really taken off quite a bit in the recent years. There's been a lot of progress on getting really high sensitivity, high frequency oscillators. So for example, in Oscar Painter's group at Caltech, there are these silicon nanoscale beams where they have these co-localized optical and acoustic modes that have very high mechanical quality factors. And then there's these fancy patterned structures that have very high Q factors as well. And also carbon nanotubes have demonstrated extremely good sensitivities where this thermal Brownian motion limit is all the way down at the zeptonewton level in a Dilfridge environment.
Z zepto, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
10 to the minus?
21. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so yeah.
Q's are very impressive,
yeah. So this industry is really advancing. It's interesting to think about whether these kind of sensors could be used for these short distance experiments, for example.
We're going away. How much mass, though? They are not very big in mass.
Well,
right?
Yeah, so the mass is listed femtograms, nanograms. It's pretty small, yeah, that's right. Yeah, so depends on what you're trying to measure, I guess, right? Yeah. So. Okay, so this particular formula is a particular case of the general fluctuation dissipation theorem, where we have a relationship between the thermal fluctuations and dissipation. And so I can rewrite this formula for the spectral density of force noise in terms of some dissipation, taking the Q out and putting back the damping term. So I have the mass times the damping coefficient times KT. This is completely analogous to the case of Johnson noise in a resistor. I've got this 4KT again here. This is the resistance of the electrical circuit here. This is like the mechanical resistance, if you like, of the harmonic oscillator. And this is even more general than these two cases. And there's a way you can generalize it, in particular in terms of this mechanical susceptibility function or susceptibility function in general, where the imaginary part of that susceptibility function divided by the frequency times KT is going to be related to the spectral density of position fluctuations, for example, for the oscillator. And again, that imaginary part of the susceptibility is that same function I had up before. And there's this relationship between the force spectral density and the mechanical displacement spectral density given by that square of the norm of that function. So in the quantum limit, we need to consider, it's interesting to think about now that we're getting systems that are actually in or approaching the quantum limit. As temperature goes to zero, then the thermal motion of the object is no longer relevant. This has been the case for the folks in the cold atom community for quite a while. It's now starting to be the case for people doing these solid state resonators. And in this limit, then you're left with basically the 0 point fluctuations, rather than just from the harmonic ground state motion, rather than any thermal energy. And so then you can generalize this form of that fluctuation dissipation theorem into the quantum case, where you have this hyperbolic cotangent form. And this agrees with the classical case and the high temperature limit, as you'd expect. Okay, so apart from the, let's see, how am I doing on time? I've got 15 minutes or? Oh, yeah, I won't take that long. Okay, so then apart from the issue of the Brownian thermal noise, one has to also potentially be concerned with whether you can detect the motion of the object. So even if you're limited by the, even if you're not limited by the Brownian thermal motion, you might still be limited by your ability to measure the displacement of the oscillator. And so there's a number of considerations you have to take into account there. And so I want to just look at one example, for example, optical detection. There are other ways of detecting displacement of oscillators, for example, capacitance and so forth. But so in the case of optical detection, then we have to be concerned, as LIGO is as well, with the discrete nature of photons that imposes some measurement imprecision on how well you can measure displacements. And at the same time, if you want higher and higher precision, you have to get more and more back action. You have to worry about the force imparted on the object from the photons you're using to make the measurement. And this leads us to what's known as the standard quantum limit, what I just wanted to say a little bit about for the next couple of slides. So going back to the LIGO sensitivity, we were showing how that we have this situation at the higher frequency end of the spectrum where we're limited by photon shot noise, counting the discrete photons. And so in general, if I have an optical cavity, I want to read out the displacement, I have some scaling or the phase. So if I keep an optical cavity on resonance, I get a peak, for example, if I were to look at the transmission, for example, and the phase of the light right around that peak is maximally changing. So if I have some length change in the cavity, I can get a phase shift of the light coming out as it deviates from the resonance condition. And the amount of phase you can detect basically is scaling like 1 over the square root of the number of photons. So the more photons you have, the smaller phases you can detect. But at the same time, you can't arbitrarily increase the number of photons, because as you measure the position more precisely, then Heisenberg tells us that there's some uncertainty momentum. That uncertainty momentum is then going to affect the position of the oscillator at a later time. And so there's some back action from that force, which is going to scale like the square root of the number of photons. And so we have something called the standard quantum limit, where those effects are approximately equal. So if I look at the spectral density of position for the harmonic oscillator, I have some contribution from thermal noise, which may or may not be there depending on the temperature. But then I also have some shot noise from my measurement imprecision. And I also have radiation pressure shot noise from the back action here. This is the force density of the radiation pressure fluctuations times the mechanical susceptibility. And there's a sort of uncertainty principle you can write down with the product of this radiation pressure shot noise and the measuring precision noise, where the product of those has to be bigger than h bar over 4. So it's interesting to plot this as a function of laser power versus measured noise versus laser power. So you have, in the case of low laser power, you're limited by imprecision noise, where you don't have enough photons to detect the displacement at maximal sensitivity. At really high power, you have back action from too many photons. And there's an optimum point in the center that's known as the standard quantum limit, where the displacement here is at the level of twice the value of the 0 point fluctuation.
So in this system, yeah, you're assuming there is something, your harmonic oscillator has a mirror and you shine light on it that measures,
yeah, that's
like
right,
a cavity.
Like,
right?
A cavity, yeah.
So this is taking, so the the imprecision is coming from your ability to measure the phase that you mentioned
before, yeah, for example, right? Right, yeah, that's right.
And the radiation pressure noise comes from just hitting it too hard.
That's right, from the momentum imparted by the photons, right?
Okay. Okay, so that's this right. is analyzing that specific system. That
yeah, that's right, just as a concrete example. Yeah, I just
okay.
pick one particular
okay,
example
great.
To
okay.
keep the discussion yeah. focused, right? So if I look at the spectral density total, then I have some contribution from thermal and quantum noise. So for example, if I may only have zero point motion if I'm all the way at zero temperature, but I also have some imprecision noise and I have back action noise as well. From the radiation pressure. So,
is it necessary that minimum standard quantum limit matches where the thermal noise is?
No, I mean the thermal noise can be zero, right? If you're at zero temperature,
yeah.
right?
So this can be above. So this is.
But it's generally true that it's twice the value of the 0 point fluctuations.
Huh.
That's generally true.
Why?
You get a quarter from each contribution, and then a quarter h bar omega essentially.
If you have thermal noise,
for each term.
Thermal noise should be negligible.
Yeah, and there are ways.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of experts. Like there's ways around this. If you do something called squeezing, mechanical squeezing experiments, where you trade off one for the other. Right. So, but I wasn't gonna take us too far afield to get us to the coffee or whatever, but I'm happy to chat with people afterwards.
I hope that you trade-off.
Right. Okay, but it's interesting that systems are now, you know, getting in the regime where we can really see these effects. And so there was a nice experiment done in 2008 with atoms in a trap where they measured this is from Dan Stamper Kern's group at Berkeley, they measured the heating rate of atoms in a trap that was attributed to this radiation pressure shot noise, where they had the atom cool down at its mechanical ground state in the optical potential, and they could measure this back action effect as a heating rate on the atom in the trap. And then for solid state systems, there's a nice result from Cindy Riegel's group a few years back, where they measured basically the radiation pressure shot noise on a membrane. So there's some contribution here from 0 point motion and from thermal fluctuations and then from radiation pressure shot noise. So as you increase the power, this is scaled to the value at the standard quantum limit. If you increase the power significantly above that, you get back action heating from the radiation pressure, and they were actually able to measure that in the lab for the first time in a solid state system a few years ago, which is pretty exciting. In the LIGO interferometer, advanced LIGO interferometer, this is actually expected to be one of the dominant noise sources limiting the sensitivity. So these mechanical systems are really getting into the regime now where quantum effects are starting to be visible. This has been the case for quite some time in the atom community, where we've had a number of great experiments going on over several decades accessing the quantum behavior in these kind of systems, where we have control over both the emotional and the internal states of atoms. But now with the research that's been going on in this field for cooling solid-state mechanical systems, we're now at the case where now we have systems that are these larger structures that are actually mechanically cooled to the quantum ground state in some mode of vibration. So this is just showing some of the activity that was going on over the last decade or so. And so now these are the first three realizations where these mechanical systems are actually in. It's pretty amazing. I think they're actually in the quantum ground state of their vibrational mode, at least of some particular mode of vibration. So this was a dilatational resonator that was in Andrew Cleveland's group, where they put it in a cold enough fridge. It has a 6 gigahertz mechanical resonance. So if they get it cold enough, it's actually occupying the quantum ground state. And people have done cooling, laser cooling of this by Oscar Painter's group of this co-localized optical and acoustic mode in this photonic crystal resonator, and managed to cool this to the ground state. And there's also work with superconducting circuit technology at NIST, cooling membrane oscillators into the quantum ground state. So we're really actually in the regime now where we have mechanical systems at the quantum limit. And in this case, it's interesting to consider the limits in these systems. And so one technique for reaching the quantum limit is resolved sideband cooling, or cavity cooling, as it's sometimes called. So so a cartoon version of that, basically you have a laser hitting a mirror on a movable element here. So let's think about this cantilever beam here with a spring with one of the mirrors on it, and so I can look at the optical force imparted by a laser on the mirror in that cavity. And so if I arrange things so that the laser input to the cavity is sitting below the resonance frequency of the mode occupying that cavity, then I have a process here where the motion of that mirror can cause a Stokes and anti-Stokes processes where I have sidebands appearing, where I have a blue shifted and a red shifted sideband, where the blue shifted sideband is more in resonance with the cavity than the red shifted sideband, which leads to a process where we can pull energy out of the mechanical oscillation because we have a higher phase space density here for the blue shifted mode. And so this can be used to extract mechanical energy or do work on that system to cool it down. And so this is the principle of that was used to cool this oscillator here in the so-called resolved sideband limit, where the mechanical frequency is detuned large enough compared to this cavity width.
Yeah. It's not just cooling, it's damping as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's so true. I'm gonna
gravity wave days, we never used this terminology back in the 90s, you know.
Yeah.
We just called it cold damping. That sums up everything. Where I've seen talks where people think they can get a better frequency stability because they use this technique to cool, but the ratio of Q on T remains.
Yeah,
constant.
I'm actually gonna make
absolutely constant.
Yeah, absolutely. I was gonna make that point in a couple of slides actually. But yeah,
and,
you're absolutely right. Yeah.
We did resolved sideband cooling back then.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
We did that.
Okay,
and
interesting.
I
yeah.
Show Kippenberg our results which where they did that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'd like to see that actually. Yeah, that's
So I'm just saying this, like our gravity wave bubble is not the mechanical system that has
yeah.
all these same properties, and there's a lot of gravity wave people here, and we all use the terminology cold damping.
Right, okay.
And resolved sideband was cold damping in the regime where you could do QMD or something.
I see.
Call it resolved. That language wasn't there then, but measurements were done.
Huh. Okay. Well, yeah, that's yeah, thanks for the comment. So right, so then, what was that?
I pointed out at many conferences.
Yeah, no, I think, but I was gonna make one point about the sensitivity though in this. So while it's true we can use these systems to get into the quantum regime, I'm gonna skip over some details maybe since I don't wanna go too long here. But the point I wanted to make about as far as the force sensing applications in particular is precisely the one that you mentioned, where when you do these kind of techniques, call it cold damping or cavity cooling or whatever, you tend to basically damp the mechanical quality factor at the same time as you cool, right? So while it's true that you cool the motion down into closer to the quantum regime as you do this, you don't actually improve your sensing ability for measuring forces, for example, from this limit, right? Because you essentially are reducing the temperature in that by the same factor, right?
The cooling power is given by the
cooling power.
The amount of cooling power you can get in your system is the mechanical Q of the system. So the higher your
You can't pull any more, right? You can't drop the Q below one, essentially, right? Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Oscar Painter didn't get 10^10 mechanical Q. I've never seen.
That's correct, but he started off at a low temperature to begin with, right? Didn't he or? Yeah, I'm not sure, but yeah, I don't remember his exact number. But right, so this isn't strictly true. There's also a limit from the heating process of the laser cooling, which depends on how efficient you are or how well you are in this so-called resolved sideband limit. But if you are in the limit where the mechanical frequency is very large compared to the line width of the resonator in your cavity, then you can keep this effective term here much smaller than one. And actually get all the way to the ground state, which has been demonstrated. So in the case of the microspheres, like I mentioned in the talk yesterday, then there's an additional term where we also worry about. That's this momentum diffusion process I discussed from Rayleigh scattering or photon recoil heating, which also plays some limitation in the force sensitivity. And so this thermalization rate here is determining something about how good of a system it is to get to the ground state. This, I think, maybe the point you were making. So if you want to have a system that's a good candidate for ground state cooling, you want the ratio of the initial and final photon occupation number to be basically less than that mechanical Q factor in order to use the cold damping method to get it down to the ground state. So these levitated spheres, like I was showing yesterday, are a very promising system for not only sensing but also getting to the quantum regime. This data here was, this effect from the photon recoil heating was seen only last year for the first time, and this graph is again showing the extra limitation that gives you on the sensing capability of that system that's due to that quantum effect. Okay, so let me just summarize. So this theorem, fluctuation dissipation, is very general, and it's useful to understand limitations in certain measurements. For example, thermal noise in optical coatings and the force sensing limits. And now that we're actually in the regime where we have a lot of mechanical systems either at or near the quantum limit, we've seen radiation pressure shot noise, we have ground state cooled oscillators, we expect radiation pressure shot noise to be a limit in advanced LIGO. It's interesting to think about the ultimate quantum limits, and the levitated optomechanical systems may be another excellent group of systems to eventually get into this regime as well. So I just wanted to end there.
So to reduce the effect of thermal noise or radiation pressure noise, you increase the mass. So LIGO, advanced LIGO, has heavier mass than previous LIGO. So we hear about shot noise in atom interferometer, but I haven't heard it. I don't know what they talk about radiation pressure noise in atom. Atoms are so small, you don't have big sample. So maybe you can address that.
Radiation pressure would be coming from spontaneous emission, which is when we spontaneously emit, the atoms recoil out of the ensemble, so it's more or less negligible.
This consider it in your analysis.
It's there. It's small. There.
Okay, it's small. Yeah. But atoms are small compared to these the other test masses. So I'd like to understand why it's so small. Anyway, it's your talk, right?
Save that question, we can answer it again.
Sounds good.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Sorry, too many people are raising it.
One thing that's sometimes useful to talk about, in some cases, when you have a system with a queue, you want to sense it, drive it on resonance.
Yes.
Sometimes you want to do it off resonance. Sometimes it doesn't matter, right?
So yeah, that's a good point.
What
good
sort
point.
Of conditions?
Right. So for the thermal noise, if you're limited by the Brownian thermal noise, then it actually doesn't matter whether you're on the resonance or below it in terms of your sensitivity, right? So then it's a question of your displacement sensitivity, right? So oftentimes in these experiments, at least in our experiments, we deliberately choose to operate on resonance because we have a bigger signal of the displacement, and then we're not as limited by displacement detection concerns. But if you have the ability to detect off resonance, in some ways the experiment's more straightforward and simpler to deal with. And so it's a kind of a consideration in terms of your displacement sensitivity.
First, I think you're very brave to give a talk like this. So it's like, I can't imagine ever accepting that. So since you're in pedagogy mode, how do you explain to, say, a Scientific American or below audience squared of n for shot noise?
Sorry, how do I explain squared of n?
Squared of n for shot noise.
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, I would say, you know, if you have a laser beam or whatever, and you measure the number of photons that strike a detector in a given time interval, and you repeat that experiment. Okay, maybe this. All right, never mind.
A lot of alcohol get drunk and then walk. But in the distance, how much you walk?
I want to know why it's a squared event. And so, I mean, we all know the textbook, the Rife type of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well,
you can do that to at that audience level. Easily. I'm wondering if you have a trick.
Are you just saying, so you have some. when you have some...
No, you guys all immediately understood what it said.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can come with that on the fly, on the spot here, but, yeah. But I mean, it's some Poisson process, right? I mean, it's not easy to explain. But, right.
You can sort of do it by just considering, you know, adding ones with plus or minus signs in front of them, and just do it for a few low numbers.
Like numerical experiments.
I think say you've got something which would be either plus one or minus one.
Yeah.
And now you start going out of the pot and then compute. And you'll discover it goes like the square root of
it. It's like magic, doesn't it? I mean, somebody who hasn't read the derivation, that seems like magic.
Right, but if you say actually now you talk about it this way, you have this thought experiment where you've got, you know, plus ones and minus ones, and you just pick them out and average them and see what happens.
Empirical.
There's going to be a correlation between one time and another, and that averages to zero. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get the square
root. Yeah, it's a white noise kind of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, but if you do a numerical
example, the concept of correlation is hard to explain to you know.
Sure.
The first thing I learned when I got to University of Washington, okay, somebody took, and I was going to teach elementary physics, somebody came to me and said, look, I want to tell you something. He said, students don't understand abstractions. Don't talk in abstractions. Always do a concrete example, okay? And in fact, there's a lot of truth in that.
It's just a comment.
Sure.
So does this thing of fluctuation dissipation apply to vacuum fluctuations?
So
what is the dissipation in vacuum?
Yeah, it's spontaneous.
No, there's fluctuations, of course, but what is the dissipation?
Right. So I mean, it certainly applies in the quantum limit. No, go ahead. Yeah, I mean, you probably have a better answer.
Any
yeah.
kind of field where there's nothing but vacuum, QCD vacuum, QED vacuum, that's the vacuum, and then there are field fluctuations, right?
Okay, but to measure it, you need to couple it to some system and then apply to that.
So it is tied to measurement?
I mean, it's like the thermal bath, or it's a thermal bath or a zero temperature bath, right? I mean, so in the case where there's a zero temperature limit of the theorem, right, where you have. There's only the zero-point motion, and you still have a fluctuation dissipation theorem in that case.
So
you're thinking of the thermal occupation, or the number occupation of the vacuum basically being zero, except for these...
Yeah, that's the high-quality cotangent half of it. That summarizes the quantum buffer.
But for quantum zero-point motion, it still applies, right?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, well, if not, let's thank you again.